Continue our study of God's Word this morning in the book of 1 Peter in chapter 2. And last week we started our study of the section from verses 13 to 17, which is the first of several applications of the commandment that he gave to us in verse 12 particularly, where he's taught us to have our behavior honest among the Gentiles, so that those in this world would glorify God for the good works that they see us do. We are in this world, and it is God's will that we be in this world. As Jesus prayed in John 17, we're not to be of it while we're in it. We must come out from it as we've been called out of the darkness of this world into God's marvelous light. And he said that in verse 9 of this very chapter that we've studied. So as part of that coming out from the darkness of this world and walking in his light, we are to be examples and behave ourselves among those in this world in the manner that a Christian should. And then he gives us several applications of that principle. And so we started our with the first of those that he gives, beginning in verse 13, and it really goes down through verse 17, and that is where he teaches us to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. The next application in verse it's going to start in verse 18 and actually continue down to the end of chapter 2, where he's going to give us some teachings that apply to that particular application and all the other ones that he gives. But then when we get to chapter 3, he's going to give us some more. But the rest of chapter 2 from 18 down is going to deal with our when we're in the position as servants under earthly masters, and then wives towards their husbands, husbands and the way they're to treat their wives in verse 7 of chapter 3, and then how we are to treat one another as our fellow Christians from verse 8 down through several verses into chapter 3. So we have a lot to look at with these applications. Are particularly looking at this one now in verses 13 through 17, which we started into a good bit last week, but we do have some things to continue with that. But let's read those verses again as we continue our study this morning. So 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17 says, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." So, of course, there's a lot in those verses. And as we pointed out last week in verse 13, just to mention again, as we see the context of it, but that word submit, hupotasso is the Greek word there that means to subordinate. So the word submit is exactly that. If we subordinate ourselves to an authority, we are submitting to that authority. And we noted that in every authority arrangement, God uses this same word in the scriptures in the New Testament. And there are two words that are closely related together. This word submit, which is also translated subjection a number of times. But then the word obey, which is a different word, but those two words submit or subject, subjection, and obey, or obedience. Those are two words that God uses for the authority arrangements he's placed in this earth that we are going to be a part of, at least, we would say at least two of those for all of us in this world, but generally three or more of those will come up in our lives. So these are very common applications of what he's teaching here, and it's good to recognize that what these words and understand these words and why the Lord uses them for all of the authority relationship, because all of these ultimately had to do with our being in subjection to God, and that's the authority. So Christ has all authority in heaven and in earth, as we noted from last week, what he says in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 19. And we even looked at the second psalm, and it's where it's quoted in Acts 13, where it tells us exactly when Christ was given all authority in heaven and in earth, as he was given all the nations of this world for an inheritance for him to rule over. And when did the Father give the Son all authority in heaven and in earth? On the day that he raised him from the dead. And so as we also looked at Philippians 2, verse 9, and obviously we're reviewing here a bit of these scriptures we saw last week, but he has given him a name which is above every name, an authority that's above all authorities. So is there any legitimate authority that exists that is not Christ's authority? And I mentioned the word legitimate because somebody might claim authority that they don't have. So that would be a false authority. But any actual authority that exists, whose authority is it? It's God's. And that's why we have to, that's why he uses the same words for all of them. Because in all of those cases, we're submitting to God's authority, whatever the application is. So here, when it comes to the ordinances of men, I mean, he tells us to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man, but he says for the Lord's sake, because that is his authority. There's the reason for it. So we have to subordinate ourselves to that authority. We have to obey that authority that he's given. And one of the things that we're going to see through all of these applications is that our responsibility, our duty to submit to the Lord's authority, is it dependent upon how the one who possesses that God-given authority is exercising it? It is not. So with all of these, when those who have that authority, now does God teach the ones that he's given authority to the proper manner in which to exercise that authority? So as Christians, they're going to also be, throughout our lifetimes, there are going to be certain of these situations where we're going to be under authority, but there will also be situations in our lives where we're going to have authority. And God teaches us how to submit to authority, and he also teaches us how to exercise authority when we have that authority. So there are teachings for all of that. But when we're looking at the side of of God's commandment for us to submit to his authority and whatever those applications are, if the one who possesses that authority is not following what God teaches about how to exercise it properly, does that absolve us or remove from us any obligation to submit to that authority of God? And it doesn't. And that's where we really have an opportunity to be an example to others, which is what he teaches us in verse 12. That's the reason that he gives us the example of Christ and his footsteps to follow in, as he's going to particularly show the necessity for us to submit to all of these authorities that the Lord has given in our lives, regardless of how that authority is being exercised upon us. So if someone is being unfair with it, if they are actually persecuting us using that authority, we still have to submit to it. We still have to obey. So that is important for us to recognize and to see that opportunity to be an example of a believer. And that's what he was pointing out in verse 12. We are to have our behavior honest among the Gentiles. And that word honest is that word kalos that means good, particularly as it appears to those that in the world. He's that whereas they do what in verse 12, just as a refresher? Are they going to see our good works and say, is there everybody going to say, it's wonderful, that example of humility you're showing, I want to know about that hope that is in you. Well, that's what we would desire to happen, and that he covers when we get to the next chapter, and especially chapter 3, verse 15. But very often, we would even say more often, far more often, what's going to happen as far as the way that those in the world are going to respond to the difference they see in our behavior from theirs. I mean, it's going to be a rebuke to them. We don't have to tell them, you're doing wrong here, like when they won't obey the laws. When we're obeying the laws of the land and they're not, do we have to say, well, look what I'm doing, I'm obeying the laws of the land? No, we just do it. But when we do that, that example, what does that say to them when they're not? Well, they're getting a rebuke. And how do people respond to that usually? Well, what did he say in verse 12? That whereas they speak against you as evildoers, so are they going to praise us for the good works that they see us doing now? Mostly no. Who's going to be glorified by those good works they're seeing? God is. When? Well, even if they're railing against us and speaking against us falsely in this life, they're seeing what we're doing. And ultimately, God says on that day of visitation, literally that day of inspection, that's what that word means, judgment day, when the Lord's going to inspect all the works that all mankind has ever done, God is going to be glorified by the good works that we've done by all of those. Are they going to be kneeling before their judge at that time and having to acknowledge, yes, even though throughout their lives they rejected him, are they going to have to acknowledge he is the king that he did possess and does possess all authority, even though they didn't submit to it, and that the ones who did, that they saw, that they will glorify him for the good that they saw. That's what he says will happen. Which is also why he says, by our example of following God's will in this, in verse 15, with our well-doing, doing what is good, what does it do to what they're saying with their mouths? He says that we'll put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. What are they going to really have to say against us for when we've done well? They might say things now, they're ultimately, they're going to be put to silence. They may even be put to silence in this life when they recognize some things. So some of that may happen now. And for their good, that's something we should pray for those that we are around, that they would see that and recognize that this is the example of Christ, and that they do consider their ways from seeing that, and that they stop with the evil speaking and then ask us a reason of the hope that is in us. If we took the time right now, which we don't, not going to do, just going to mention this, but when Jesus was crucified between the two thieves, who railed on him? They did. At the beginning, they both were railing against him, but what do we know happened with one of them over the course of those hours of hanging there? He changed. And he thought about what he was dying for, and he also thought about the one who was next to him and what he was dying for, and he repented. The way he felt about his situation at first, he had a reaction and he railed against the Lord, but his death was coming and coming rapidly, and he knew it, and he rethought his situation, didn't he? There's an example of that. People can, they may start off responding in a very negative way against us, but they may rethink things, which is a reason why if someone curses us, what does the Lord tell us to do? Curse them back? Bless them. Pray for them. Because we should be concerned with their souls. We should recognize and understand they're opposing themselves as we once did. We would like for them to then come and have a change of mind about it and ask us the reason of the hope that's in us as they see that difference. And that can happen, as we just noted with that example of the repentant thief that was crucified next to Christ. So he tells us to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. And as we noted last week, it's not just whoever the top one is, but also to those whom he sends. Because if the king or the president, the prime minister, the governor, whatever the title is, whoever's got the authority, the higher up they are, they're going to have more people that are going to be sent by that authority to exercise that authority. So we're usually going to be, generally speaking, is our contact with the civil authorities going to be with the highest levels or much further down? Usually it's going to be much further down. So can we take the position, well, these are minor authorities and we don't have to pay any attention to them? That's why it says every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. And if that one in authority sends someone, that's by that authority. And whose authority is that? Of course, it's Christ. I mentioned a moment ago that we're all under certain authorities in our lives, we're actually born into that in a couple of ways. From beginning on day one, whose authority are we under? We're under our parents' authority. So we're born under authority in our families. At the same time, we're all born into some nation, some principality. We're going to be under civil laws or rules. Now, usually when you're a minor, dealing with those authorities isn't going to be quite the same as when one is an adult, unless one is from very early on is really rebellious, and that can, one can come into very, very early contact with those authorities with bad behavior. So, but we're all born into some, in some land of, as part of some nation, we're all under civil authority. So, I mean, when are we ever just on our own without any authority over us? Well, none of us are. And so throughout our lives, we're all going to be under civil authority. Until we're an adult, we're going to be under parental authority. That may transfer for women when they are married, then they're going to be under the authority of their husbands. But how many of us will have jobs at some time in our lives where we're under authority in that way? I mean, there's so many. These applications he gives us are part of that. When we're in the church, we're under authority in the church that the Lord has placed in the church. So, I mean, all of us are under multiple authorities, but all of those authorities are the one authority of Christ, which is the point, and that's what he starts off mentioning there in this passage in verse 13. Now, for parents and exercising authority, do parents ever, are they ever busy with something and they may send one of their children with a message to another of their children? Certainly. Any of us that have been parents are very familiar with that. In fact, if we look back when we were children in our houses, we probably were on the other end of that, where we had a brother or sister come to us. Mom said, with some message. Now, what happens a lot of times with children when they get the message from mom through one of their siblings? How do they respond to it? Do they respond to it the same way as if it were mom's voice directly? Which, that is a big issue, too.
We discount that, but generally, not the messenger is not highly esteemed.
And that's a point he's making here, and that's the reason he mentions this. And of course, if you end up abusing the messenger, Jesus used that example when he was talking to those Jewish leaders and gave that parable of the Lord of the vineyard who sent his servants to take the fruits of the vineyard, and they were abused and killed until he sent his heir, his son, and they killed him. Well, what was the in the parable? I mean, who were those ones that he sent? Those were the prophets, and of course, then God sent his son. But how did God's people respond to the prophets who were sent in God's by his authority? So here were men with the message from God. Did men treat that message as if it was from the Almighty himself? They didn't. How often did they kill the prophets that were the messengers sent by God, with God's word as the message? And, of course, ultimately with Christ himself. This principle comes up a lot, and it does right here in verses 13 and 14. So we don't submit only to the top, to the governor or the king. We have to submit to the king, but as a Christian, we recognize that king is under the King of Kings, Christ. So if we understand that properly, like the Roman centurion did, he had authority as a soldier over 100 under him. And when he would send his soldiers to do something, if he said, go here, or go there, do this or that, what would the soldiers under his authority do? Yes, and he knew he didn't have to physically go to all of to carry out whatever he was instructing those under his authority. Now, as the centurion, whatever those ones he sent out and to do whatever with the people, if they were not listened to, would the centurion might he get involved, or would require of the subjects that were not properly responding to the ones he sent under his authority? Well, that would certainly that be the case. But he recognized authority structure, and that's when Jesus, when he had a servant that was sick, did he think Jesus needed to personally come into his house in order for him to be sent? Or did he recognize that Christ had the authority of God, and all he had to do was speak the word? And by speaking the word, it was God's word, and it would be carried out because it's his authority. And Jesus marveled at that, because how many people have such a clear understanding of authority and how it works to where they're going to be willing to submit to God's authority in all these ways in which it is manifested? And Jesus marveled at his faith and said he hadn't seen like it among the Israelites, and that he was a Roman. But that principle is there, and that's what's being applied in this case here in verses 13 and 14 also. And these ones that are being sent by the ultimate authority, what are they going to do if that submission isn't given? Well, he says they will punish the evildoers and praise the ones who do well. Now, that's the way it will normally go. Are there cases in which those that have authority will misuse it and then actually punish the ones who are doing well and persecute them? Yes, that can happen, which is a point that we want to look at here shortly. But for now, we're looking at recognizing that principle that that authority is being exercised from the top down, but all of it is the Lord's authority. So all of these civil authorities and their ordinances, we have to submit ourselves to every one of them because it's the Lord. And so for his sake, that's what he teaches us to do, because Christ has been given all authority in heaven and in earth. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. On that matter, we know that on the day of the Lord's resurrection, his Father gave him all authority in heaven and in earth. So before that day, who had all of that authority? Well, obviously the Father, because it's the Father who gave it to the Son, as it was prophesied in Psalm 2. Thou art my Son, this day have I begotten thee. And he gave him that all authority in this earth, in heaven and in earth. Well, you can't give what is not yours to give, can you? So the Father couldn't give that authority to the Son if he didn't first possess it. Now, when the Father gave his Son all authority, then here's a question. Does that, if he gave his Son all authority, is the Father then under the authority of the Son? Is there something that doesn't quite sound right about that? Well, no, he's not. And this is something he actually speaks on here in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 27 and 28. And this chapter is dealing with the resurrection of Christ, so this is the timing of when this happened. But he says, "For he hath put all things under his feet." He has put all things under his feet. Well, who is the first he, and who is the second? Well, this would be the Father having put all things under the Son's feet. That's going to be clear from the rest of 27 and 28. But when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him to put all things under him, that God may be all in all. So that's where it becomes clear. He's talking about God the Father and then his Son. So the Father put all things under his Son's feet. But when he says that all things are under him, and when he says he's given all authority to his Son, he says it is manifest, that is, it is revealed that he is, and the word there is accepted, not accepted as in A-C-C-E-P-T-E-D, as in received, but accepted with an E-X-C-E-P-T-E-D, which means it's an exception. The Father is the exception. All are under the Son's authority now because the Father's given it to him, but did the Father put himself under his Son's authority? No, he's accepted himself from that authority that he's given his Son. That's the one exception. So the Father is not under the Son's authority. He gave him all authority, but the Son is the one exercising the authority the Father gave him, but he's not over his Father. And then he says, when all things are subdued unto him, when all things have been put under his feet, then It says the Son also himself will be subject, and there's that word again, being subordinate to his Father again. He's going to give that back to the Father. From what he describes, as he says, the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death, he said in verse 26. And then back two verses before that, even in verse 24, the Son is going to deliver up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. So when is the Son going to present his church, those that are in his church, the citizens of his kingdom, when is he going to present them to the Father? Well, this is obviously after Judgment Day. We're going to be brought into that heavenly city, and he's going to show us the Father. He's going to present us to his Father, and then we will be the bride of his Son forever. But at that time, after Judgment Day, all has been put under Christ, and he's going to then, that authority is going to go back to the Father. But the Father's not under the Son's authority. So he does specifically mention that there in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 27 and 28. Is the Son then going off on his own doing all things, or is the Son following the Father's direction in the exercising of that authority? That's what he's doing. So he's doing the will of his Father in everything. The Father's not submitting to the Son, but the Son is submitting to the Father in all of that. Let's turn to Romans chapter 13, which is a parallel passage to what we have in 1 Peter chapter 2 in verses 13 through 17. And many of the same words, but certainly the same principle and subject is being taught on here. But let's read from Romans chapter 13, 1 through 7. So as we saw in 1 Peter 2, 13, that we are to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. Starting in verse 1 here in Romans 13, he says, let every soul be subject. So there's the same exact word, hupotasso. So we are to subordinate ourselves. Again, he says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. So he's very clear in the source of the authority, that all authority that's exercised in this earth and all the ordinances that we're under, all the laws of the land, they are from God. Those authorities exist given by God. So when we're resisting, if we resist the authority, if we refuse to subject ourselves, who are we resisting? And who are we refusing to submit to? God. And that's why he uses those same words in all those authority arrangements, because it's all from him. So in any aspect of our life when we're under authority, if we're not following that authority, subjecting ourselves to it and obeying that authority, regardless of what that authority is doing or how they're doing it, then we're resisting God and refusing to submit to God. Now, last week we noted the one exception to that is what? If we are commanded by any authority to disobey God, where it's directly contradicting what God said, then what did we see in the, as we noted from Acts 4 and chapters 4 and 5, when the apostles were commanded not to teach or preach anymore in the name of Christ, what did they say? We ought to obey God rather than men. That was a case where they had been commanded by God to go preach, and when any authority of man was saying don't do what God said, then what did they had to choose. So when that authority was commanding something to be done outside of God's authority, well, did they have God's authority for that commandment? No. In that case only, we cannot obey. But the rest of the time, is it dependent on our what our personal feelings are about the particular rule or law or whatever that is? No. Well, what if we voted for the opposite? I mean, that's not what he doesn't say, as long as we agree with it. And really, in fact, if we only had to submit to authority when it suits what we were going to do anyway, are we really submitting? I mean, are we making any sacrifice then, when it's the same as we would have done anyway? When does it become painful? Well, particularly when it's something different than we want to do. And when we want to do one thing, if we have the authority that's saying we got to do this, well, what do we do? It's the Lord's authority, so we need to make sure that what we desire to do is consistent with that authority. We have to submit to it. If we don't, since it's God's authority, then we're going to be under his condemnation, he says at the end of verse 2. So continuing on here in Romans 13, verse 3, he says, "For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil." Well, that's their purpose. We saw the same thing in there in 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 14. He says, "Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same." Now, isn't that generally true? I mean, do we need to be afraid of the civil authorities if we're obeying the laws? Again, we're not looking at the exception when those authorities are not, when they're opposing righteousness. We could look at the example of what was going on at the end of the first century under the reign of the Roman Emperor Domitian, when he compelled empire-wide, throughout the Roman Empire, required all to acknowledge Domitian as a deity and to worship him. He wasn't the first of the Roman emperors to claim divinity, but he was the first to require that all subjects in the Roman Empire worship the emperor as divine. Well, what Christian could obey that? They couldn't, and thousands, tens of thousands of Christians were put to death across the Roman Empire during that time. That's the context and the time in which we read the book of Revelation being written, and what was going on then. So it was very severe persecution of Christians, and at that time, if we'd been under that climate and we'd seen any kind of a Roman authority in our presence, would we have been afraid? Well, there would have been good reason to be. But apart from when authorities are not following what the Lord has said and turn against his followers and are persecuting them, other than that, I mean, in general, when we're doing what's right, do we have to be afraid of anything? No, and that's his point there. But if somebody's doing wrong, do they need to be afraid? Do they need to be concerned about the cops if somebody's breaking the law? Well, yes. So that's what they're there for. That's what he's talking about in this context here. So he says in verse 4, "For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to exercise wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore, you must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake." So now he's talking about those who enforce the laws. Well, they're the ones sent by the authorities of the land to enforce those laws that are there. If that didn't exist, if all we had were laws on the books and there was no enforcement, then how many of those laws would be followed? How peaceful and orderly would society be if there was no enforcement of any of the rules of the land? It wouldn't. It would be chaotic. It would be anarchy. The devil would be running amok. But the Lord is the one keeping order in this world. And is that for the good of all that there's order in society? So we can live our lives in a peaceful and godly manner and following the Lord? That's very important. It also makes it much more possible for us to be able to spread the gospel to others. If we were trying to live life as Christians and preach Christ to others, and we were, and it was just chaos all around us, and nobody was obeying any of the laws. And there are times and situations where that sort of thing will break out, and it's mayhem. I mean, and we should be very thankful that that's not the way things are, but that requires there to be law enforcement. Now, again, if everyone were a Christian following what the Lord teaches, would there be any need for any law? Would there be a need for police? Dare I say, if everybody in Colombia were like we are, would there need to be city police or the Richland County Sheriff's or Lexington County, whatever, wherever we live with it? If everybody was like us, would that be needed? I hope none of us have ever had the cops called on us, but I mean, that should never happen. We should never give cause for such a thing. And there shouldn't be a need for any of that for us. But we understand that, I mean, Christians are the few in this world, and so many others wouldn't follow the laws, and if they weren't being forced to. So Christ is exercising his authority as Lord over all through these which he calls his ministers, his servants there. So these authorities, including law enforcement, he refers to them twice there in verse 4 as ministers of God. So who are they serving when they're exercising the authority that Christ has and that he's given to the rulers in this world? Then who are they actually serving when they are enforcing those ordinances and that authority that God has given through Christ his Son? They're serving the Lord in that work. Now, do they know that? Very few would. If some were Christians, they should understand that. But I mean, how many of those that possess authority in this world understand that they've been given that authority by God? They are his ministers. They don't know it for the most part. Example, in the Gospel of John, chapter 19, 10 and 11, it says, "Then saith Pilate unto him," to Christ, "Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee?" Jesus answered, "Thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin." It says, "And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him." Now, Pilate, who did he think had authority? Himself, and he thought all that was his. Did he understand that was given him by God? And Jesus is pointing out, whatever power you have over me was given by my Father. And so these ones, was Pilate God's minister? Did he have authority? Did he have God-given authority in his position? He did. He didn't recognize or understand it was from God, but it still was. When he's compelling an answer from Christ, Christ was otherwise silent, but when he compelled an answer, Christ gave it. When the high priest, Jesus, was silent, and this was fulfillment of prophecy. You can read it in Isaiah 53, that as a lamb before the shears is dumb, so Christ, he was silent before the ones who were judging him. He didn't speak much. But when he was compelled by their authority that was given by God, did he answer? Yes. When the high priest, when he says, I adjure thee by the living God, and he asked him, are you the Son of God? What did Jesus say? Did he maintain his silence, or did he submit to the authority that was given by God to the high priest and then answer him as he was being commanded to do? He answered him. He said, it is as you say. And that's when he tore his garments. And what do we need of any further witnesses? He accused it of being blasphemy, but it wasn't blasphemy. He was speaking the truth. But he answered that question. It was a direct question compelled to him by the authority over him. So Jesus submitted to that authority also. What if that authority is doing evil? Pilate was he doing the right thing when he says, I have the power to crucify you? And ultimately, what did he do? He used the authority he had and delivered Christ to be crucified. Now, he was seeking to have his release. He knew he was innocent, and even went through the ritual of washing his hands before all the people to say, I'm innocent of his blood. But was he? And Jesus said, the ones that delivered me to you have the greater sin. Did he say, you don't have sin? I mean, who was doing worse? I mean, the ones who were behind the whole thing, trying to seek to have him crucified. But Pilate agreed to it. And why? He was trying to keep order. And of course, in his mind, even if an innocent man died, if that pacified all the people and kept, what would happen if the whole city had gone in a riot? Well, Pilate had those over him. And then who would be judged for that situation? So this is where the Romans, as long as the taxes were being paid and order was being kept, they let people follow their law, their local laws. But Pilate was trying to avoid a riot, so he was willing to let an innocent man die for that. So was that proper use of the God-given authority that he had been given? No, it wasn't. So he was Jesus was being treated evilly by that authority in this case with Pilate, even though Pilate recognized his innocence and preferred to set him free, but he didn't. And what do we do if authorities are mistreating us? Do we now, are we free to not obey? And by the way, right after that in Romans 13, 6 and 7, he says, for this cause pay you tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And that's referring to the authorities. And he mentions the ones who are collecting the taxes. Well, I mean, how many of us enjoy paying taxes? I haven't met anybody. Anybody in here, and don't really raise your hand. I don't think you'll need to. Is there anybody in here that's ever, you paid your taxes, that, you know, really, that's not enough. I think I should be giving more. And then wrote a separate check to give to the government that was over and above what they were taking from you because you just felt like you weren't given enough. Anybody done that? I don't think any of us have ever done that. I mean, who wants to pay more taxes? I don't think there's really anybody that wants to do that. Even the richest, I don't think they're doing that. People pay what they have to pay, but nobody wants to pay that. But as a Christian, if we have to pay that, do we pay it? What did Jesus teach when he was asked that question? Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God's what is God's. Jesus taught that as well, and he followed that. So when they were asking for his taxes, he got Peter to pull a fish out that had it in its mouth. But he paid it, didn't he? So he's an example of submission to that authority and is the teacher of where that authority comes from. All right, we're out of time, so let's go to our Heavenly Father in prayer as we close.